Welcome to another episode of For the Medical Record, the podcast hosted by the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine here at Johns Hopkins.
Yes, yes, yes. And I am one of your hosts, Antoine Johnson.
And I'm Christy Slobogan. And today we are so excited because we just had an interview with two incredible individuals who are working with the Opioid Industry Documents Archive, the OIDA. The archive is documents created by opioid manufacturers and related companies, and it's hosted jointly by the UCSF, University of California, San Francisco Library, in collaboration with Johns Hopkins. So we interviewed Caleb Alexander, who is a practicing internist and epidemiologist here at Johns Hopkins, and he focuses on maximizing the use, safety, and effectiveness of prescription medicines. And then we also interviewed Jason Chernesky, a postdoc on the OIDA project. Dr. Chernesky is a CLEAR Opioid Industry Research Postdoctoral Fellow, and CLEAR is the Council on Library and Information Resources. And so they're both working with this archive on the academic and on the public engagement side.
Yes, we had a wonderful conversation with them about these documents, which hover in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 million different documents. And that might be on the light side as it continues to grow. Some of the topics that we discussed today, a term that public health scholars like to use, commercial determinants of health. We discussed public-facing work as they published an article in the American Journal of Public Health in 2022. We also discussed geography of empathy when thinking about drug usage and epidemics. And we close out with discussing writing the second draft of the story of the opioid epidemic. You know, what will that look like to a national audience? So sit back, enjoy the conversation. Let us know what you think. Peace. Okay, so could you please summarize what the Opioid Industry Documents Archive is, or the acronym for this being OIDA, and what inspired and facilitated its creation?
Of course. Well, this is Caleb. And first of all, thank you for having us and for helping us to shine a brighter light on the archives and to disseminate information about it to the broader communities. The archive is designed to serve as a repository for documents that arise from opioid litigation and that reflect a variety of different industries that have contributed to the opioid epidemic. And so there are dozens of important cases that are taking place around the country, enormous litigation taking place against opioid manufacturers and distributors and pharmacies. The archive is designed as a digital repository where documents that are arising from litigation can be placed and can be made freely accessible for all to use so as to generate fundamental new knowledge about the opioid epidemic and to allow individuals that might not otherwise have an opportunity to use these materials to understand more about the genesis of the epidemic and how further harms can be prevented.
Thank you, Caleb. Jason, could you give us some concrete examples of what kinds of documents are included?
Yeah, so it's really quite a comprehensive account of the way industry operated before, during, and after the crisis had emerged. I'll just take a step back a little bit, and Caleb just mentioned this here too, in that these are all coming out of litigation. So these are documents that are being produced in the courts or in the service of the courts to sort of sue the companies, right? So a lot of the documents are gathered in that way. However, not unlike the tobacco industry documents. However, back to your question about like what is actually in there, it's really a rich collection of materials, not just for historians, but for anyone who's interested in how these companies were operating on the inside, right? So the public would be interested in these documents, all types of scholars who study things from health policy to business histories to legal history, right? Social histories. I mean, there is really kind of a number of questions that could emerge from these documents. And some of the ones that are in there that are particularly rich are the emails that we see between people working in the companies. You have everything from emails to slide decks that I can't tell you how many number of PowerPoint presentations I've looked at. And the fact that they are now historical documents is fascinating, but they are in and of themselves very fascinating. You have sales reports, sales spreadsheets. There's a lot of spreadsheets and how sales teams were operating. You have also other documents that were being collected in discovery, such as public health information, things that were being written about the crisis, studies that were being done by companies, third-party companies that were coming in and doing studies for the companies, collecting data, right? So you have really a real panoply of different kinds of sources that you can really use. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And because we're also still going through them, we're still processing a lot of them. So even though there's over, 2 million now, Caleb, I believe, getting close to 3 million documents and many more millions to come, we're constantly finding new stuff that's in there that's particularly fascinating in terms of the types of documents.
Yeah, it's so clear, even just from looking at the website, how expansive this collection is. And it's really impressive. But you mentioned, Jason, the tobacco industry documents. Can you explain a little bit more, either Jason or you, Caleb, can you explain a little bit more about how the opioid industry document fits within the wider industry documents library, and what that is and how that was started and where the opioid documents fit into that?
Yeah, well, you know, about 20 or 25 years ago, there was a raft of litigation against the tobacco industry. And there was such intense public scrutiny and such intense demand on the part of the public for access to documents arising from that litigation that as part of the master's tobacco settlements, which generated, hundreds of billions of dollars ultimately to help address harms that had occurred from tobacco marketing and promotion for decades, the tobacco documents were put into the public domain. And, you know, it's worth reminding people that typically these sorts of documents never see the light of day. That is, it's an unusual case when documents arising from litigation are released and made public. Typically, the right of the public to see these is, I don't know if you call it a right, but the potential or the promise of the public to see these is bargained away as part of the terms of settlement, so that these documents are essentially never released and never see the light of day. And so we're fortunate that UCSF, because of their leadership and their activities at the time, they were selected to house the tobacco documents. That really helped to birth the industry documents library, which has sat at UCSF for 20 plus years. The majority of the documents in the collection to date are tobacco related, although they also contain documents from other sectors, the food industry, for example. There's promise of this sort of archives to expand to other areas, fossil fuels, handguns, and so on and so forth. But the bottom line is that the opioid industry documents archive builds upon the legacy of and the good work that UCSF has done for more than 20 years managing the industry documents archive, which has primarily focused on tobacco documents. And the opioid industry documents archive, or OIDA, O-I-D-A, reflects a collaboration, therefore, between our two institutions, Johns Hopkins and the University of California, San Francisco.
Yeah, just to add on to what Caleb was saying, and I agree 100% with what he's saying there about how really unique it is to have these kinds of documents where you can see the inner working of these industries, and particularly they're publicly available, right? Like, this is not something that is typical of other types of collections. What's really unique about what the folks at UCSF has done, people like Paulina Ilieva, Rachel Takeda, and others who have been working on those documents for well over 15 years now, in some cases, depending on who we're talking about, have done a really great job of, you know, having researchers have access to them. But in terms of the larger scope of the industry document library, or the IDL, really what is wonderful about it and unique is this ability to search across all of the industries, right? So one of the really big things that we've been discussing here at Hopkins is how the OIDA industry documents specifically, but also the IDL more broadly, speaks to this phenomenon, what public health scholars have been calling the commercial determinants of health. And I can't think of another set of papers and collections outside of OIDA and the broader IDL landscape where the commercial determinants of health can be interrogated in a very robust way. So this, you know, this new set of documents that are coming into the IDL are going to really, not predicting the future, historians don't like to predict the future, but I can see the potential in really sort of fleshing out how the commercial determinants of health play out in the 21st century. So this is going to be a really exciting set of materials.
Thank you, Jason and Caleb. Something that both of you hinted on is UC San Francisco or UCSF's collaboration with this work. We were hoping that you could elaborate a bit more on how the collaboration between Johns Hopkins and UCSF came about with these projects, and why are these two universities, you know, united in the curation of these documents?
Well, we at Johns Hopkins have had a sustained interest in the opioid epidemic for some time. And there are many, many faculty at Johns Hopkins that are deeply engaged in generating fundamental new knowledge about the genesis of the epidemic, as well as the effectiveness and impact of varied interventions to prevent further harms. So based on that work, and also based on knowledge of the litigation, and there are some of us, I, for example, have served as a paid expert for plaintiffs in opioid litigation. So I've had the opportunity to see firsthand the type of litigation taking place, and really to understand better what's at stake here. You know, those experiences generated an interest on our part in housing documents such as these. On the other hand, we were aware going into this that UCSF had tremendous experience and a long history of successfully hosting the tobacco archives and housing the industry documents library, and doing so in a way that really has led to transformational policies that have changed the way that tobacco is governed and regulated and managed in the public space in the United States. And so several years ago, we began conversations with UCSF, understanding, as is often the case, that we're stronger together than we are apart. And the last thing that I wanted as we were thinking about this was to, you know, was to compete with an organization that we could potentially partner with and bring complementary skills and complementary areas of faculty expertise and really build something together that would not have been possible with either one of us alone.
Thank you. Jason, did you want to add to that at all? Or?
No, just, Kale, I'm not pandering here, but I do think there's some log rolling that might have to happen in that, like, in terms of the collaboration. I mean, people make collaborations happen. Caleb has been, you know, really kind of an important sort of leader out front in really making sure that this collaboration not only happens, but how that collaboration has strengthened, even in the short time I've been here. Yeah, I just wanted to add that bit to in terms of how these collaborations happen.
No, that's so important. And it's important to give those kudos when they're deserved, because collaboration is often very difficult to figure out how to start it within academic spheres. And we always do better work when we are working with across universities or across disciplines. Those answers that you guys have given give us a really good foundation for what the OIDA is, what the archive is. But I want to hear a little bit more about the work that each of you is doing specifically with the OIDA, with this archive. What kind of projects are you working on right now? What are you doing kind of in the day-to-day with OIDA?
So as the CLEAR, the Council for Library and Information Resources fellow here at Johns Hopkins and on the OIDA project, you know, one of the really big goals that we have is to increase engagement. I'm part of a sub-team within the larger OIDA organization that focuses on engagement specifically. So we have a number of things that we're working on. One is we're working on in trying to increase engagement with scholars. So expanding the network of scholars who are going to be using the archives for all kinds of things, ranging from history to public policy and drug policy. So to get back to what Caleb was saying, so that the impact of what is in these collections can be, you know, really felt through the kinds of scholarship and policy initiatives to help sort of mitigate this problem, but also to help prevent it, something like this, from happening again. So really trying to, again, expand that network, get a diversity of scholars involved. And we have a workshop coming up in May, on May 5th, in fact, and there will be some publicity about this coming out very shortly, where we're going to invite scholars to come in from different fields to actually engage with the collection itself. So they may have questions that they have, research questions that they want to try out. They may just be curious. Either way, working with UCSF, we're going to bring those folks in online and have a kind of online workshop where we're actually engaging with the collection, and also having scholars who have used OIDA in their own research to explain how they've done that, right? So that's a really important short-term goal. But the long-term goal is to use that as a springboard to expand research initiatives and actual research production so that we can get more people interested. That's one. Number two is finding a way to use the documents to engage with the public. Now, public, obviously, right, needs to be defined, and it can be a very broad term, but there's a couple publics that we're really sort of interested in. One, obviously, is the folks who've been really directly affected by the epidemic, so bringing them into the fold and really using their insight and input into structuring different ways that we can engage with them, make their stories better known, enhance the collection's materials to tell their stories, okay? Those types of things. So that's one public. Another kind of public is just the general public, right? So what are some opportunities that we might do to use this as a mechanism for public engagement, right? One of the things I'm working on is using things like story maps, which is a really interactive technology that can tell a lot of really accessible stories online, but also literally highlight the documents and stories of other people embedded in those stories that we tell, right? And then it could link to the collection so folks can actually look at the documents themselves and see where they might want to, you know, go further and read, right? Honestly, like Caleb was saying before, I personally feel this as well. Like, there's a lot of documents in here. If the public reads them, would really get, even though they might know the general story, looking at the language, looking how the companies were operating can really give them an insight that you don't get anywhere else, right? And it could generate questions, it could generate, you know, curiosity, it could generate knowledge, right? All of these things that are important that the collection's doing. So really trying to get as many people engaged is a real important thing. And one of those things is we're redesigning the website. So the engagement group has been in conversation with the web redesign. I'm working on an introductory page right now that's going to make it a little bit more accessible for new users to get into the collection. So those are just a couple of things. And then obviously some of the side projects that I'm doing are, you know, sort of looking at the documents. So this is the third thing, to sort of generate some research questions. And, you know, we could talk a little bit more about that later. Some of it's a little inchoate at the moment, but I have some broader questions that I'm, as a historian and a scholar, that I'm interested in as well.
That's a lot. That's very good. Yeah. Caleb?
Yeah. Well, you know, our challenge and our opportunity is to maximize the use of these materials by many, many different parties. And we really want to set 1,000 ships a sail. That is, we want to develop new ways of reaching different parties and develop new entryways into the archives and make it easy for people to engage in the archives. In July of 2022, we published a paper in the American Journal of Public Health entitled the Opioid Industry Documents Archive, a living digital repository. And in that paper, we provided a dozen or more examples of important questions that have not been yet fully fleshed out. Questions such as, what methods did pharmaceutical distributors use to monitor the opioid supply chain? Policy questions like, what strategies did manufacturers use to respond to regulatory concerns regarding opioid safety? Legal questions like, what was known by manufacturers at what time and by whom regarding the potential risks of addiction and overdose? And also sales and marketing questions. What strategies have been used to market opioids to women, to adolescents, to veterans, and racial and ethnic and cultural minorities? So these are all examples of questions that, sure, they may have been touched upon in some court proceedings, or you may be able to read a few sentences about them in some legal complaint, but they really have not been fully explored, nor have the answers to these been used to really shape policies and rules governing opioid manufacturing and marketing and promotion and distribution and dispensing in ways that ensure that we never experience this again. So I'll close with just one final example, and this is one that's closer to home because we actually have this research project underway. So we're taking some of the major myths that have been propagated, some of the major misconceptions that have fueled the epidemic, such as that opioids are way more effective than other products for managing complex chronic pain, or myths such as that you can essentially, that there's no dose that's too high, and that if somebody is not getting adequate pain relief on a lower dose, that you should simply increase the dose. Or myths such as that if you titrate down somebody's opioids, invariably you're just going to push them to heroin or illicit fentanyl. And so what we're doing is we're looking at the sorts of scientific articles that have been used to buttress these assertions, to support these assertions, and we're looking at the ways that that these claims have been supported by articles that maybe have been misconstrued. Maybe the population studied really didn't warrant the ways that the article was spun, or maybe the studies were for 4 weeks, but were spun as implying that opioids were safe or effective for a much longer period of time, and so on. And so this is an example where I think Jason was speaking earlier to the commercial determinants of health and what we can understand looking across industries. And this is an example where we know that in other settings and other industries, the ways that science has been weaponized, and in some cases, you have pseudo-scientific claims that really aren't fully supported by the evidence to date. And we're doing a careful job of examining this in the context of key myths and misconceptions about prescription opioids.
Thank you, Caleb, and thank you, Jason, so much. We really do appreciate the work that y'all are doing, and I love the public-facing work and making it accessible to the public. That's huge. But on a different note, given that this is a podcast sponsored by the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine here at Johns Hopkins, we are hoping to steer the conversation in that direction a bit and figure out, glean from both of you how this project, the archives, fits within these disciplines of medical humanities and or social medicine, and how might, the work that disseminates from these projects move those fields forward or in different directions, similar to the article in the American Journal of Public Health. Any other hopes or expectations?
So in terms of the medical humanities, Cecilia Tamari, who's head of the engagement work group, has been working on some really important educational initiatives. And I think, we were talking about research and the potential use of these documents for research. There is a really big opportunity for educators in the medical humanities to leverage these documents to teach either future practitioners or practitioners who are now early in their training in medical school to see the ways in which these companies can really, you know, in an almost banal way, you know, make their way into the sort of conversations and policymaking that goes on that maybe some early medical professionals in training aren't very well aware of. For example, one of the things that we're developing right now is a set of public health policy labs for a group of teachers who are using some of the documents to show, for example, you know, just how intertwined industry was with particular policy and lawmakers, right? So really sort of getting them to understand through the documents how these processes work, right? As a way of sort of, you know, then, you know, these are, in this case, these are folks who want to go into health policy, right? So how do you start to write new policies that can start to chip away or get rid of these loopholes, or call them loopholes, but you know, the way that business has been done for years, right? And to start rolling that back through policy. The other ways I think that there's some potential here in the collection, and this is the historian speaking, or the historian slash STS scholar speaking here, and that is there are a lot of questions that can be answered, particularly as we look at the role, you know, either large corporations play in population health over time, and also, you know, the ways in which we can start to rethink about, you know, what role they should be playing in how policy is made. You know, Caleb could speak more about drug policy and sort of the larger epidemiological outcomes of these larger historical phenomenon. But, you know, just as a side note here, you know, building on work like David Hertzberg, whose recent book on white market drugs is really wonderful. And his book sort of ends at the beginning of the opioid epidemic. And he gives a really wonderful history of the policy, you know, or non-policy actions that were being taken leading up to and that led to this crisis. And in these papers are a number of stories that people who are interested in social medicine and medical humanities can tell about how that's happening in the late 20th and early 21st century. What's in there, I don't know. People have to start digging, but I have full faith in, you know, looking at those, you know, looking at those documents to start answering questions about, you know, what are some of these larger underlying structural phenomena that lead to, you know, disproportionate health outcomes in the country, and how we can sort of make better policy to ensure that we help those who've been affected and prevent it.
Yeah, this is the worst drug epidemic in our nation's history. And what the archives does is it provides a vast expanse of information that historians and social scientists can use to understand one important part of it. It is true, and it's worth underscoring. The archives provides one window through which to view an incredibly complex and multifaceted problem. It's not the only window, and nor are the industries that are featured in the archives the only industries or the only organizations that have driven the epidemic, but it nevertheless provides an incredibly valuable opportunity for historians to learn from. And I think that the tobacco archives and the way that it has been used by historians of science and other social scientists provides one example, or serves as one example, of the value and sort of the road ahead. But we're also at a really exciting time in the computational humanities. And I want to say I'm watching this from the side. I'm an epidemiologist and a practicing internist. I'm not, I would never characterize myself first and foremost as a computational humanist. But with that being said, we are at a unique moment in time where we have an increasing number of people and tools and capabilities to make sense of these vast troves of digital information. So I think that there's enormous work to be done, and I would suggest that the archives is an incredibly valuable place for individuals to come in order to tackle what is arguably one of the greatest public health problems and tragedies of our time.
Sorry, I just wanted to add on to what Caleb was saying, because I'm glad he brought up the computational humanities. But there's a way, I think, and to think creatively in the medical humanities and social medicine to leverage these kinds of new digital tools to not only understand this particular drug epidemic, but then to sort of, you know, use those tools to sort of compare and contrast other tragic drug epidemics that we've had in the United States. So, for example, as someone who studies the history of HIV/AIDS in the United States, and, you know, this is how I'm coming to and why I'm so excited to work with this collection, is because, you know, I'm coming at it looking at the merging of two other previous drug epidemics, heroin and crack cocaine, that devastated Black and Brown communities in the United States in the 1970s and 1980s. And now we have another drug epidemic that's affecting other marginalized communities in the U.S. in the late 90s and early 2000s, right? So you can get a sense, right, if you really, you know, people who are dedicated to understanding this and want to use new tools to understand the, you know, the breadth of these kinds of drug epidemics, there's a real great opportunity here to sort of see what are the similarities and differences. And in understanding those similarities and differences can help us better understand how we're going to move forward to think about the opioid epidemic, not as a standalone thing, but within this larger context of how we deal with drugs in the United States, drug illicit and licit drugs, right? Mm-hmm. And the gray areas in between those.
So Jason, you took some of the words right out of my mouth, and especially, you know, you earlier mentioning David Herzberg's book, and I'm thinking about Carolyn Acker's book, Creating the American Junkie, and just different ways in which drug use has been criminalized over time across ethnicities. And piggybacking off of what Caleb was saying about this being one of the biggest epidemics in U.S. history, and I'm thinking about a huge New York Times op-ed that dropped a few years back, maybe 4 or 5, where people who are still around from the crack epidemic are saying, you know, where is the compassion for people who were addicted to crack, drug use being a public health issue, but crack being criminalized, but compassion through the opioid epidemic, you know? So thinking about how drugs affect people across ethnicities over time. And this segues directly into our next question. You know, as Christy and I, we just had an amazing conversation with folks from the Black Beyond Data Project. So this had us thinking about the digital humanities a lot lately. So our next question is, how do, you know, each of you see things like the digital humanities and projects like OIDA interacting with, you know, and changing, you know, practices of history, and to bring it closer to home for us, you know, the medical humanities in the future?
I just wanted to touch on something Antoine just said about this sort of this geography of empathy that we're thinking about here, because I do think one of the things that I'm interested in as someone who studies the effects, the dual effects, or really the trifecta of heroin, crack cocaine, and HIV in the 1980s and 1990s, what this research in OIDA has helped me as a scholar do is look back and find ways to sort of retell that story in a way that humanizes and broadens that geography of empathy that we saw that, you know, emerges out of the opioid epidemic. And even that, when we talk about compassion, I mean, that's even complicated, right? Who's being in the popular press being held up in the opioid epidemic as quote unquote innocent victims and so on. So the language is similar and different, and we want to sort of interrogate that. And I do think this collection is a way into understanding those questions, right? And getting into the dirty, nitty-gritty, complicated geography that's there. Leaving that aside, moving on to the digital humanities, if I had enough time and access to resources and people, there are so many things that can be done with this collection. Everything from mapping projects to, you know, following and mapping people in the collection, you know, using, I mean, the fact that these folks produce so many damn spreadsheets, you can just mine their spreadsheets and create really fascinating digital humanities projects, right? It's just a matter of getting the critical mass of people to use them, right? That have the tools, knowledge, and skill set to start using digital humanities in that way. And that's something I'm learning as a CLEAR Fellow, but I would love to get more people involved that are doing some of these things. And we have some folks like Tom Lippincott here at Hopkins, and Caleb can talk maybe a little bit more about him and what he does as a computer scientist. But there are folks who are engaging with this that are in that broader umbrella of digital humanities. But, you know, just to put a finer point on it, there's a huge opportunity here to do that.
Yeah, it's been said that what America or what one thinks about addiction depends upon who is addicted. And I think that there's no question that there is a lot to learn using these materials regarding the ways that the opioid epidemic has been framed, and the ways that race and ethnicity and culture have been interwoven with the response to the epidemic, as well to learn about how this epidemic has progressed similarly to or progressed quite differently from other drug epidemics, and how the response to it has varied over time, over populations, and so forth. So, you know, again, I'm trained as a practicing internist and a pharmacoepidemiologist. So my primary area is not one of sociology or history, but I think that there's no question that there's enormous interest on the part of historians and sociologists and anthropologists and other social scientists in better understanding these matters. And, you know, there is also an enormous opportunity because we're at a unique moment in time. There's enormous opportunity for the archives to represent in a space where computer scientists and quantitative sociologists and others that have sophisticated computational skills can come to generate fundamental new knowledge. And we want to do everything that we can to make it easier for these individuals. We simultaneously are focused on being sure that there are good on-ramps to the archives for individuals with lived experience, for individuals that, for the general public and so on. So, you know, there can't just be one front door to the archive. We have to, if we're going to be successful, we have to build on-ramps and entryways for different types of people to come to the archive so that they can use it for as they wish, just as with a good public library.
That's great. I love that kind of analogy of the archive to a public library. I think that's a really good way of thinking about it. So I'm going to kind of wrap a couple questions together. But this is more asking about like a specific either document or story or theme, but I'm wondering if there is one story or one character or one narrative that has caught your eye or surprised you while mining these documents. Is there any specific thread that you want to highlight and maybe tell an abridged version on the podcast?
So there's a number, but I will focus on one because it's something that I'm particularly interested in. It feeds back to what Caleb was saying before about one of those unanswered questions that wonderful piece in the American Journal of Public Health sort of lays out, and that is how these companies were monitoring illicit use, or, you know, the off-label use and sale of these drugs. And there's some really fascinating documents in there about Mallinckrodt was one of the companies that produced some of the, you know, largest amounts of generic opioids in the country. And when, you know, there was pressure to sort of monitor where these things were going, they literally sent people out to watch pharmacies in Florida. So some documents I came across where they were looking at pharmacies in Florida and like a weird stakeout of pharmacies. They're collecting all this data. For some reason, they talked about the race of the people that needs to be unpacked, the different pharmacies that they're going to.
Do you just mean like CVS and Walgreens?
Walgreens, but also smaller shops, right? And so, you know, local pharmacies. And why I find that story so fascinating is I don't understand why they did it. And so I'm trying to understand why and how they were doing this when they well knew what was going on, but they nevertheless went through it. And it could be the answer might be straightforward once we do some more digging. But I have to imagine there's a larger story there. And, you know, just going through it and reading the emails and going back and forth, how they're describing these places is just like really kind of nuts. But yeah, there's a lot of other stuff in there, but that's the one that kind of jumped to mind when you were talking about that. But it also sort of loops back into these larger questions that Caleb had raised earlier about like what else needs to be interrogated in here. And that's one of them, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much. The archives has some very well-known documents that have already seen the light of day. You know, there's a very famous email exchange, or infamous email exchange, I should say, on the part of a Mallinckrodt executive. And the executive receives an email which says, quote unquote, "just got a release today. You will receive 1,200 bottles on Thursday morning." To which the recipient replied, quote unquote, "keep them coming, flying out of here. It's like people are addicted to these things or something. Oh, wait, people are." To which the sender replied, quote unquote, "just like Doritos, keep eating, we'll make more." And so this is a very famous email exchange that, again, has well seen the light of day. But there are, for every one of these documents, there are thousands upon thousands of other documents that, again, help provide context to understand just how it is we've ended up where we are. Again, the industry documents don't provide a complete picture. These industries that are represented, we don't have all of the communications that took place within them, and they aren't the only factors or drivers that have helped fuel the epidemic. But nevertheless, these sorts of documents are hugely informative. The other example that comes to mind are some documents that I've been looking at recently that were produced by McKinsey, not an opioid manufacturer and not one of the key industries, you know, not a manufacturer or distributor or a pharmacy chain, but of course, a major consulting company. And there are many documents in the archive that arose out of a settlement that McKinsey reached with the attorneys general that showed just how McKinsey consulted with and provided services for Purdue Pharma, among other opioid manufacturers, that really served as the basis for Purdue's strategies, for example, in negotiating with payers so as to gain favorable placements for their drugs on formulary. So the archives contains an enormous trove of materials that I think any listener to this podcast who has an interest, I hope they'll be curious enough. I hope you will be curious enough to take a look for yourselves and see what you find.
That was good. Thank you. So to pry a bit as we wrap up, could both of you, matter of fact, inform us on what's coming up and what are you most excited about to continue to unpack in these documents? Can we expect another Hulu series from what comes from what people find in here? It's just like, what are you excited about for in terms of next steps with the OIDA project?
I'm most excited about the enormous momentum that we have. We have two remarkable institutions that are deeply committed to this work. We have been fortunate to have had remarkable support from attorneys general around the country who have made it more than clear that they're committed to document disclosure as terms of settlements or judgments that are taking place. I'm excited for the thousands of individuals that we anticipate that will use these documents and use the archive in the months and years to come. And as anybody that has been impacted by this epidemic knows all too well, there's not a moment to lose.
Yeah, and just to wrap up too, the things I'm excited about is mentioning the Hulu series Dope Sick, which based on Beth Macy's book with the same name. You know, I think the first draft of this story has been well written, but the second draft is still waiting to be done. And so what I'm excited about is to collaborate with and help all of the scholars and the public that are interested in understanding a depth of the story that needs to further be told to get access to these collection. So anyone who's interested, whether you're a scholar or, you know, part of the public, although like those two things are separate, they're actually, we are part of the public, meaning if you're not doing this for some scholarly research, to really contact us, to get in touch. I mean, it's really easy to find us. And, you know, I would love nothing more than to build a kind of interdisciplinary approach to understanding this collection and getting that second draft out there. And having part, when I say, you know, interdisciplinary, I mean folks who are affected by this. And what Caleb's saying, I mean, that really is a big mission of what we're doing is, you know, if this is going to be a public library on this, you know, the ways in which some of these companies participated in this tragedy, then, you know, we want those folks to come in and look at that. And we can help them sort of point the direction like any other, you know, arbiter of these kinds of public resources, this public good, which is what it is. So yeah, I'm excited to see what those second drafts of the story are going to be.
That's great. Thank you so much, Jason. And thank you, Caleb. Thank you both of you for talking to us. I think this is a really excellent project and, you know, we'll help to get some of the word out as well here. And we'll link to the OIDA project and the article and everybody else that you've mentioned throughout this episode in the show notes. Thank you to both of you, and we'll see you around the department and yes, around Hopkins. Yeah. Thank you so much.